Today's Wednesday, June 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Fighting continues to rage across Afghanistan.
Most of the time, it has been the Taliban that have overrun dozens of districts.
Plus, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken returns to Europe Wednesday. His first stop, Berlin.
In Berlin, countering anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial will be on the agenda.
And what needs to be done to prepare for the next pandemic? We'll have these stories and more next. Fierce fighting continues to rage across Afghanistan, where officials reported on Tuesday that security forces had reversed some of the recent advances by the Taliban. Ayaz Gul is following the story from Islamabad. Ayaz, please bring us up to date on what we know about the fighting.
Well, those claims by the government side that they had retaken certain districts obviously was the only good news in the past month or so, because most of the time it has been the Taliban that have overrun dozens of districts. I mean, as of today, if you go by what the Taliban have officially announced, is that they have captured more than 86 districts since May 1st, when the American and NATO troops began formally pulling out from the country. Although, and we know that today there was a briefing at the United Nations Security Council on Afghanistan, where the UN representative in Afghanistan, Deborah Loin, told the council that in the last 1 month, Taliban have captured more than 50 districts. So that's a lot in terms of the battlefield advances that the insurgents have made. So even though the government forces recaptured few districts, but when you look at the overall situation, the Taliban seems to be having this victory spree, where there are clearly concerns that they are apparently aiming at Kabul and finally entering Kabul through their military means once all international forces leave the country by the September 11th deadline set by President Biden.
So what does this mean for the hope of intra-Afghan talks and the prospect for peace?
Well, that process has already been, you know, caught in so many problems and challenges. And with this latest battlefield attacks and victories the Taliban have made, has, you know, dealt a serious blow to this peace process that everybody was hoping would ultimately produce some kind of a peace arrangement between the Afghan government and the Taliban. But what we need to know, we need to understand, is that very few people talk about the fact that these peace talks that the Taliban were holding, they were holding these peace talks from a position of strength, like they were presenting themselves as the government in waiting in Kabul. So that is what actually led to this deadlock in the talks, that they are not willing. They have not been willing from the outset to accept the Kabul government led by President Ashraf Ghani, because they have continuously condemned or denounced this government as an outcome of the United States occupation, as the insurgents say, of Afghanistan over the last 20 years. So they just want everything to be taken back to the time before when the U.S.-led invasion occurred almost 20 years ago, and want to determine the fate of future governance according to their terms. And that is why the Afghan government has not been willing to talk to them, and that's why the international community led by the United States have been pressuring the Taliban that it's a different country now, and you will have to compromise for an inclusive sort of government to govern the country. But that is where the Taliban apparently are not showing any flexibility. And this current campaign on the battlefield suggests, according to so many analysts here, that the Taliban want to make sure that they grab as much territory as possible before all the international forces leave the country, because the one justification that the Taliban have used for their fighting this violent campaign has been that because there are foreign forces on the Afghan soil, so they want to evict all those forces, either through fighting or through negotiations. And now that the foreign forces are on their way out, and if they are all out by September 11th, the Taliban will lose this justification for the Afghan nation that they are fighting because there are foreign forces on their soil. And it seems that before that deadline arrives, they want to have as much territory as possible under their control so that they can convince the world that because they are the dominant power, so whatever happens in the negotiations, peace negotiations, if at all they move forward, then they will dictate terms, or this is everything will happen as per their requirements. And that's where we are facing serious problems, because the Taliban are really moving on a path which is making unhappy even neighboring countries, because Pakistan is also worried, Iran is also worried, and Central Asian republics are also worried.
Right. I want to ask you about that. I mean, my last question is this. You mentioned that September 11th deadline for all foreign troops to be out of Afghanistan. If the Taliban don't go back to the table with the government of Ashraf Ghani and hammer out a peace deal and the fighting continues, does the government of Afghanistan have a plan to, you know, address that particular scenario?
Well, that's what, today the top government officials held a joint press conference where they said they have a comprehensive plan, according to them, which will take them, which will be implemented over the next 2 weeks, and that this will bring back the security situation to normalcy, as they claim today at the press conference. But we have heard statements from their side, but it seems that because Afghan security forces and the Afghan government have for years relied on close U.S. air support and advice during the military campaign, which kept the Taliban from attacking urban centers and these districts. And now that that air support is gone, it seems there is some kind of chaos and lack of coordination, even at the highest level in Afghan security forces, that they don't know how to contain these Taliban advances. And interestingly, Taliban have made more gains in northern and northeastern Afghanistan in the last 1 month, which have been traditionally anti-Taliban and non-Pashtun, ethnically non-Pashtun areas, where Taliban in the past never enjoyed support. But now with they gaining this this kind of support and these kind of battlefield victories, suggest that they had a plan in place how to go about once international forces start withdrawing from the country. But the Afghan government apparently was taken aback. Just when we are talking, we have received just maybe an hour ago more reports that several more districts have fallen to the Taliban. So we are definitely seeing a very difficult, fluid situation emerging in Afghanistan, which is not only a serious problem and challenge for people in Afghanistan, but the region and the world in general.
That's reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, Pakistan. Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani will be traveling later this week to the United States to meet with President Joe Biden. On Tuesday, U.S. law enforcement seized a number of Iran-affiliated websites. Messages posted on the sites contained language saying that the site had been seized, quote, in accordance with a seizure warrant as part of a law enforcement action by the Bureau of Industry and Security, Office of Export Enforcement, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, end quote. The U.S. Department of Justice had no immediate comment. However, two sources speaking to the Reuters news agency said that the department is preparing an announcement on the issue. At least one site, the Arabic language Masriya TV, which was part of the seizure, appeared later online, but with a different domain. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Analysts say Turkey is expected to come under pressure to remove its military from Libya when world leaders gather on Wednesday at a conference in Berlin. The meeting will include discussions on elections and the withdrawal of foreign forces from the war-torn North Africa country. Dorian Jones has that story.
Wednesday's Berlin conference is the second international meeting organized by Germany and the United Nations. Discussions will be on permanently ending the Libyan civil war and preparations for December elections. A key goal of the gathering is the creation of a framework for the withdrawal of all foreign fighters. something Aya Buela, a visiting lecturer at the Hellenic National Defense College, says is key to restoring stability.
Good governance, very difficult to establish in Libya. There's arms everywhere, militias everywhere, there's no rule of law. So the presence of foreign powers has really undermined that. So Libyans want them all out. They want to have a normal country. Most of all, they want to have elections at the end of the year.
Turkey deployed hundreds of soldiers and thousands of Syrian fighters in support of the Libyan government of national accord in its battle against forces of Libya's General Khalifa Haftar, who is backed by Russian and Sudanese mercenaries. A ceasefire is now in force. While backing calls for the removal of foreign troops, Ankara says its presence is legitimate because it was invited by the internationally recognized government. But with conference attendees, including EU members and the United States, calling for the removal of all foreign troops and Turkey seeking to improve ties with its Western allies, international relations professor Serhat Güvenç of Istanbul's Kadahas University says Ankara will likely acquiesce, at least in part.
Turkey will probably eventually come to terms with the fact that it has to, you know, take those foreign fighters from Libya, you know, the Syrian, the fighters, you know, the Turkish proxies.
A U.S. Defense Department report last year said Turkey sent thousands of paid Syrian fighters to Libya. Buela says the mercenaries are among the most destabilizing forces in Libya.
These Syrian mercenaries, their behavior in Libya is very much the same as their behavior in northeast Syria. Looting, sexual assaults, violence. And there's something very jarring about natives seeing foreign men with arms, you know, driving around their streets, you know, no accountability.
Ankara denies such claims of misconduct. Turkey's wider military presence is also expected to come under pressure. The Turkish military constructed an airbase and wants to establish a naval base in Libya, a plan opposed by Egypt and France, which are also attending the Berlin conference. But Güvenç says Ankara sees its Libyan military presence as having strategic importance.
Turkey has to keep a foot in Africa, that air force base or air base in Al-Watiya. In Libya, indeed, offers tremendous opportunities in that regard. So probably Turkey will bargain really hard to keep its presence, keep that base.
Analysts say the Berlin conference sees Ankara working to balance its strategic goals of improving ties with its Western allies while expanding its influence in Africa. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is headed back to Europe Tuesday evening, this time to Germany, France, and Italy. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain takes it from here.
After President Joe Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken's flurry of summits and bilateral meetings last week, Blinken is headed back to Europe for talks in Berlin, Paris, Rome, Bari, and Matera, Italy. Blinken, a strong supporter of transatlantic ties, is getting the red carpet treatment. He will meet with heads of state and government at all three stops, where climate change and the COVID-19 pandemic will be a constant focus. In Berlin, countering anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial will be on the agenda. Blinken will also attend the second Berlin conference on Libya, where Libyan delegates will be at the table for the first time. Expert Brian Katulis says Libya's future is looking brighter.
The main issue there is that unlike Syria or even Yemen, there actually has been substantial progress on the ground to try to pull together the different factions. And even in recent days, efforts to open up supply lines to get humanitarian aid in.
The growing threat posed by Islamic State terrorists in Africa and Afghanistan will be a central theme of the meeting in Rome by the Coalition to Defeat ISIS. Dealing with China is likely to be an issue at each stop, and perceptions over the challenge Beijing poses differ, says analyst Dan Hamilton.
The Europeans tend to speak of it as a systemic rival. The Biden administration has said adversary. So there are some wording differences here that reflect a bit difference in how sharp you want to be with the Chinese on challenges.
Another common thread of the trip is likely to be the rising threat to democracy around the world. Biden and Blinken have not shied away from uncomfortable conversations about real threats to democracy at home and abroad, says Jonathan Katz of the German Marshall Fund.
Frankly, at every moment since January, when the president took over, democracy has been front and center in almost every conversation, diplomatic, press releases, communiques.
The threat to democracy from authoritarian leaders is real, warns the European Union ambassador to the United States, Stavros Lambrinidis.
It's not just the two of us in the world today. There are others trying to break the notion that democracy and freedom is a good thing. And in some cases, they're succeeding. Well, they have to stand up and listen because the EU and the US are now together in the same room, and we are going to stop them.
Lambrinidis expressed confidence the United States and the European Union will do the hard work required to address the underlying social and economic issues that contribute to anti-democratic movements. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
Family members of alleged Islamic State militants held in Syrian camps are urging the Australian government to repatriate dozens of its citizens. Phil Mercer is up next.
Kamal Debbouze's Syrian-born daughter Mariam and her three young children are being held at the Al-Roj refugee camp in northeast Syria. They're among about 60 Australians stranded there. The Australian government has said it was too dangerous for diplomatic staff to visit the region to try to bring them home. But Debbouze believes the security situation is stable enough for his daughter and grandchildren to be brought home. But he's warned that volatility in the region could return at any time. It's estimated that 10,000 suspected widows and children of former Islamic State fighters are among 70,000 people held in the Al-Roj and Al-Hawl detention camps, according to New Lines Institute for Strategy and Policy, a US-based foreign policy think tank. Most are Iraqi and Syrian nationals. They were taken to the facilities after the jihadist group was defeated in 2019. Charities have said the camps are beset by violence, food shortages, and a lack of medical care. There are concerns that women and children are at risk of exploitation. The United States and the European Union have warned that the camps could breed a new generation of militants. Debbouze told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that his daughter and three grandchildren should be brought home.
Whatever you think of the women, these children should not be in prison. These children should be in a safe environment, at school, getting on with their lives. Every day they face dangers. Every day these children lose some of their childhood.
Mariam Debbouze said she was tricked into travelling to Syria while on a family holiday to Turkey in 2015. Her husband, Khaled Zahab, an Islamic State fighter, was killed in an airstrike on a terrorist training camp. She has said she was forced to remarry twice after his death. Germany and Finland have begun repatriating their citizens, allowing a total of 5 women and 18 children to return, according to reports. German media said 3 of the women were being investigated for allegations of belonging to the Islamic State, and the Belgian government has just announced it will soon bring its citizens home. Kamal Debbouze has urged Australia to follow their lead. He's written a book about his experiences trying to secure his daughter's return in a book called A Father's Plea. The government in Canberra has no comment on Mariam Debbouze's case, but Defence Minister Peter Dutton has said previously that Islamic State widows held in camps in Syria were not innocent women. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Ballots continue to be counted Tuesday in Ethiopia in a poll that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed calls the nation's first free and fair elections. However, the vote has been boycotted by the opposition. The election took place while the war in the Tigray region continues, and there have also been reports of irregularities. Certified election results are expected to be released within 10 days. The special rapporteur on the human rights situation in Eritrea, Mohamed Abdulsalam Bobby Kerr, presented a grim picture of the situation in his first report to the UN Human Rights Council.
There are no tangible signs of progress or concrete evidence of improvement in the internal human rights situation in Eritrea. In addition, Eritrea extended its human rights violations extraterritorially or beyond its borders during this mandate and committed heinous human rights violations in the Tigray region of Ethiopia.
Bobby Kerr says that he has received allegations that Eritrean troops in Tigray have carried out deliberate attacks against civilians, summary executions, and sexual as well as gender-based violence. Eritrea has rejected the report, calling it politicized. In addition, a coalition of 41 countries is calling for access to internment camps in China's Xinjiang region. They want to check on the situation of an estimated 1 million Muslim Uyghurs who allegedly are being detained under abusive conditions. Lisa Schlein has that part of the story.
Canada issued the cross-regional joint statement at the UN Human Rights Council Tuesday. In her delivery, Ottawa's ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Leslie Norton, stressed the urgency of getting to the bottom of this human rights situation.
Credible reports indicate that over 1 million people have been arbitrarily detained in Xinjiang and that there's widespread surveillance disproportionately targeting Uyghurs and members of other minorities, and restrictions on fundamental freedoms in Uyghur culture. There are also reports of torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment, forced sterilization, sexual and gender-based violence, and forced separation of children from their parents by authorities.
Norton urged China on behalf of the coalition to allow immediate, unfettered access to Xinjiang for independent observers, including the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. This follows a similar request made by Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet at the opening of the council session Monday.
I continue to discuss with China modalities for a visit, including meaningful access to the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, and hope this can be achieved this year, particularly as reports of serious human rights violations continue to emerge.
Beijing has described the detention camps as vocational centers aimed at stopping religious extremism and terrorist attacks. China said it welcomes a visit by the High Commissioner to China, including Xinjiang, but on condition that it be a friendly visit and not a so-called investigation under the presumption of guilt. China also responded quite differently to the joint statement that demanded access to the camps in Xinjiang. Minister Jian Duan simply ignored it. Instead, he conveyed his deep concern about the serious human rights violations suffered by Indigenous people in Canada. His statement was supported by seven countries: Russia, Belarus, North Korea, Venezuela, Iran, Syria, and Sri Lanka.
Historically, Canada robbed the Indigenous people of their land, killed them, and eradicated their culture. We call for a thorough and impartial investigation into all cases where crimes were committed against the Indigenous people, especially the children.
The Canadian ambassador acknowledged that Indigenous people still face systemic racism, discrimination, and injustice, but added her government was working to right these wrongs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Israel's impressive COVID-19 vaccination rollout has a weak link: adolescents. They're now on the front line of the campaign, with fears of the Delta variant prompting reluctant parents to get their children vaccinated. Reuters' Lauren Anthony has more.
Around three quarters of the country's population within eligible age groups have already received their shots. But Health Ministry data says that only includes 2 to 4% of 12 to 15-year-olds since the group was given the green light this month. After daily cases more than doubled on Monday, after outbreaks at two schools, many reluctant parents are now feeling pressure to put their children forward for the vaccine. Yizhak Nivo is one of them.
We came today to vaccinate Hen. She is 13 years old. And I was waiting until the Minister of Health will give the approval to vaccinate her age. When it arrived, there was no any more COVID in Israel, so my wife said, leave it. But now, after the COVID outbreak and all this situation, I said today, I don't give a damn, today.
I wanted to get vaccinated so I don't get the disease. I'm very scared of it.
The Health Ministry recommended parents vaccinate their 12 to 15-year-olds on Monday. It's even investing in outreach programs to get parents to bring their children in for shots. Israel's two largest healthcare providers say appointments for teen vaccinations have doubled and tripled in recent days. But some parents, like Eldad Askoff, aren't convinced.
There was a debate, but at the moment we feel that we don't want to vaccinate. We prefer that. It seems like if we can control it without getting vaccinated, the kids, we prefer that.
It's a dilemma. Experts say there will be no herd immunity if the younger generation is not vaccinated. But Israel's handling of the coronavirus so far has been so successful that it's dropped almost all social distancing and will open its borders to vaccinated tourists next month. Israel uses the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine on its population, but its effectiveness against the Delta variant in the country is not yet clear. Some studies abroad, where Delta is more common, have found the shot to be effective.
Lauren Anthony reports for Reuters News. And finally, when COVID-19 hit, the world wasn't ready. The pandemic showed major gaps in the preparation and ability to respond to the virus. Health experts also warn that there will be another one. VOA's Carol Person reports that it doesn't have to be as bad as COVID-19.
COVID-19 is leaving behind a world full of grief. Some countries may be emerging from the spread of the virus. Others are in COVID's grip. Some are going into lockdown. And many people, scientists included, are asking why the pandemic wasn't better contained. Dr. Tom Frieden has worked to end epidemics. Frieden is the former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
We may never know whether COVID could have been stopped, but there's something really important to understand, which is that every day around the world, public health and healthcare workers are stopping epidemics.
Another deadly coronavirus called MERS appeared in the Middle East nearly a decade ago. Again, Dr. Frieden.
I used to ask people when I was CDC director, remember that big outbreak of MERS we had in the U.S.? And they would look a little puzzled. And they said, no. I said, that's because we didn't have one. We established the ways of testing for it. We alerted clinicians. They did find cases, and there was no spread.
Frieden now heads Resolve to Save Lives, an organization that has studied how even poor countries have beaten epidemics. The study cites examples of how countries have stopped epidemics through good leadership, investment in health facilities and health workers, and community involvement. The anthrax bacteria occurs naturally in the soil. It's deadly for animals that graze, unless they're vaccinated against it. Anthrax can also kill people who handle or eat infected meat. In Kenya, volunteers are trained to watch for signs of the disease and to report it. 2 years ago, anthrax broke out in a tribal community. A volunteer reported it, health workers took action, and more than 10,000 animals were vaccinated. An epidemic was stopped in its tracks. During the Ebola epidemic in West Africa that ended 5 years ago, Nigeria was spared because of its polio vaccination program. Health workers already had community connections, and they knew how to do contact tracing and interpret laboratory data. Amanda McClellan was in West Africa during that epidemic.
Using the polio team within Lagos is really one of those success stories that we've looked at how we can amplify.
Nigeria had the Ebola outbreak under control in just 2 months, as opposed to the 2 years it took the three other countries. With the right infrastructure, the right leadership, and quick action, Frieden says several epidemics not only can be prevented, but have been prevented. Countries have to work together to prevent the worldwide spread of disease. One thing experts say that COVID-19 has taught us is the world is not ready for the next pandemic, and they say there will be another one. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.